Welcome to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. For the next hour, Monterey College of Law's Dean Mitchell Winnick and Law Professor Stephen Wagner will discuss current legal events and public policy issues that are affecting our daily lives. They will not provide individual legal advice. If you have a specific legal problem, you're encouraged to contact a lawyer for legal assistance. If you do not have a lawyer, contact the local bar association or lawyer referral service in your community for recommendations. And now, here's Wagner and Winnick on the Law.
Welcome to another edition of Wagner and Winnick on the Law. I am San Luis Obispo College of Law professor and trial attorney Stephen Wagner. And as always, I am joined by my co-host, president and dean of Monterey College of Law and San Luis Obispo College of Law, Mitchell Winnick. Mitch, good day to you.
Good day to you, Stephen. You know, we're going to take a real chance on today's show.
We're going out on another limb.
We're going to talk about gambling. How fun is that?
Yeah, and we can find a way to weave it into the law, too.
We are, because there is actually an area of law called gaming law.
This is true.
And we just couldn't resist it, because with the brackets coming out tomorrow for the NCAA basketball tournament, there might be just a little bit of gambling going on.
That's true, and I think we'll find that the college tournament is probably one of the most popular gaming events, sporting-wise, I would think.
I bet our guests will let us know that, but that wouldn't surprise me in the least. I bet it is, because it brings, you know, the people who pay no attention to sports for much of the year get caught up in March Madness. And, you know, it's just because it's a nice long couple of weeks. Everybody has a college team they can get behind. Everybody loves the underdogs.
That's,
I mean,
there's
just so many stories
going
on.
And there's the pressure from the office bracket that's often circulating.
And I've got some questions today about whether that's legal.
But that's for amusement only, isn't it?
There's money changing hands. It sure looks like gambling to me.
Well, the ones I've always seen always say amusement only.
Well, that's because you do them in a law firm. But if you're anywhere other than a law firm, do they have a bracket in your law firm?
I don't think we do a bracket in a law firm. No. But, I mean, I've seen them before, and I do see this amusement only embossed all over it. I see the same thing in football squares. Have you ever noticed that?
Yes.
You ever bought a football square?
I have indeed. These are good questions. I have a suspicion that the labeling of something amusement only is not the controlling factor in the law.
Yeah, that's true.
And this is not illegal, therefore we can do it. Just print.
Right.
Anything you want to do, just print. This is not illegal on it, and everybody's good, right?
Right, right.
I don't think so.
Yeah, hopefully you can tell from my voice I was casting that one already in some doubt.
All right.
Well, to help us in our discussion today, we're soon going to be joined by attorney Christopher Soriano. Christopher is a partner with the law firm of Duane Morris, and he works out of the Cherry Hill, New Jersey office, and he is a gaming lawyer, very well versed in the law of gaming. Mr. Soriano has represented a wide range of stakeholders in the gaming industry, casinos, private equity and hedge funds, lottery companies, gaming technology manufacturers and equipment suppliers, and individuals. I would run out of breath if I read his entire resume, so the best thing we can do is to bring him in. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
We're glad to have you. So start off right off the top. Let's talk about office brackets for the basketball tournament coming up. Legal or not?
Well, I hate to be the bearer of the bad news, but for the most part, office brackets or any type of bracket where people are putting in money on the result of a sporting event are, for the most part, illegal.
There you go,
right?
Stephen. Illegal.
Yeah. And I'll say, let me add, Stephen, that if somebody could just print on anything involving the gaming industry, this is not gaming, I'd be looking for another job right now.
I know, Chris. Chris, hopefully you did pick up that I was incredulous in my delivery.
No, I certainly did, but my heart skipped a beat for a moment wondering what I was going to be doing next week if everybody was just going to follow that approach.
Yeah.
So tell us generally how the laws in gaming lay out. So, because clearly there's international gambling going on in the internet, there are federal laws involved, and there's definitely state laws involved. So can you give us a little bit of an outline of how does law deal with the issue of gambling?
Sure. traditionally, you know, in the United States, we've been very slow as a country to embrace the growth of gambling. And a lot of what you see going on in the gaming industry now reflects the fact that a lot of our laws are outdated. So the laws governing sports pools, sports wagering, and even we're seeing it now in fantasy sports, really two sources of law. You have federal law and state law, although traditionally gambling has always been a state law issue. And when we say that, you know, office pools are illegal or some other type of wagering is illegal, that's a fairly blanket statement that, you know, you got to obviously get into the nitty-gritty of each state's law where you might want to be doing something. But most states have a crime of bookmaking, promoting gambling. They call it different things, but essentially, those for something to be illegal under state law, you've got to have three things: consideration, prize, and chance. And if you have all three of those elements, what you've got, for the most part, at common law at least, is gambling. Now, the way the federal laws have developed on this is all based on the involvement of organized crime in gambling. If you go back to the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and so on, what federal law primarily does in this area is say that if something violates state gambling law, and if it travels across state lines, then it also violates federal law. There is not a whole lot of separate and independent federal law defining what constitutes gambling for purposes of the federal criminal laws. And that came out primarily, you know, in the early 1960s. There's a federal statute called the Wire Act that was put into effect. And it came from the frustrations that states were having in terms of stopping organized crime from taking bets on sports gambling, and essentially put the power of the federal government in place to help the states enforce activities that were going on outside their borders. So that's the overall legal framework in which we're working. Now, when the internet came along, that obviously required some changes, and you know, now there is some federal law governing what constitutes gaming on the internet. But even that is deeply rooted in state law.
So Chris, Stephen here. So Chris, you seem to reference when you were talking about the interplay or the reach of the federal law. I'm assuming it's connected to commerce, the fact that it's moving from one state to another.
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
So it is linked logically to the commerce clause, right? Or at least the power source would be that if it moves from one state to another, therefore it implicates federal laws or statutes?
Yes, all of the federal statutes that govern, that apply in this area, and they're the statutes called the Wire Act, the Travel Act, the Illegal Gambling Business Act, all require an element of interstate commerce.
Well, that makes sense, because if you look into the Constitution, you can't find gambling actually mentioned in the Constitution. So that's good. That's a great premise for people to understand that this is one of those many laws that the federal government gets involved if there's interstate commerce. So the Commerce Clause then does give them a role to play in this. And I guess that also then makes sense why then the individual states, that if they want to regulate gambling within their borders, the federal government's not involved in that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why you've seen three states so far, Nevada, Delaware, and New Jersey, implement internet gaming on an intrastate basis. They've said, and that's to keep them out of the reach of the federal statutes. Those states have said internet gaming is legal within our borders. We don't know if internet, you know, take New Jersey, for example. New Jersey is likely to say, well, since internet gambling is illegal in Pennsylvania, we're not going to let anybody bet across the state line, because then we'd have a problem under federal law if we let people bet across state lines unless the bet was legal in both states. So in each of these states that now have internet gambling, there's what's called a geofence built around the states that requires a provider of internet gaming to make sure that you're located within the state before they take a bet from you.
Wow, that's interesting. I was about to ask, I'm sure everyone's scratching their head going, wait, the internet is everywhere. How do they know where my computer is if I'm logging into a gaming site in New Jersey? And your answer is the companies themselves have had to set up the technological test to determine where is the origin of that IP address.
Yeah, they typically, most companies in New Jersey that are doing it, typically do it two different ways. One is they're tracing the origin of your IP address, and second, most of them I can't say all of them do this, but the vast majority of them require you to have a cell phone. And when you log in to play online poker in New Jersey, they send a text message to your cell phone, and you have to enter the number that's been sent to your phone into the online gaming site.
Chris, hold the thought on internet gaming, because we are coming up on a break. And when we come back from the break, let's talk a little bit about fantasy sports, fantasy football, for instance. You're listening to Wagner and Winnick on the Law on the BizTalk Radio Network, and we're talking about gaming laws today, and our guest is attorney Christopher Soriano. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Deciding to go to law school brings up questions like, can I afford it? Will I be prepared to take the leap and open my own office when I graduate? I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. Have you ever dreamed of being a lawyer? We at Monterey College of Law can help make that dream come true with professors who are practicing attorneys and judges. They mentor our graduates. But don't take it from me. Hear what recent graduate Creighton Mandeville says.
I wasn't crippled in debt coming out of Monterey College of Law. I came out of it with no debt. I was able to do some working during that time and some savings, so I exited law school with no debt. I did feel prepared coming out of law school. I started helping friends with the issues that came up for them, and Monterey College of Law has so many great faculties and things that there were resources for me.
There's never been a better time to become a lawyer. Call us today at 582-4000. That's 582-4000. Or visit us online at montereylaw.edu. That's montereylaw.edu.
For 45 years, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Monterey County have been a vital part of our community. The club's mission is to inspire and empower the youth of Monterey County to realize their full potential to become responsible, healthy, productive, and successful citizens. As just one of the club's programs, more than 12,000 children and families have enjoyed safe after-school care at the Boys and Girls Club's Salinas Clubhouse. The Boys and Girls Club of Monterey County is very excited to announce that Monterey College of Law is providing one full tuition law school scholarship each year to a former Boys and Girls Club participant. For more information about this exciting opportunity, contact President and CEO Donna Ferrero at dferrero@bgmc.org or call 831-757-4412.
My Chevrolet, when you need a car, truck, say My Chevrolet, in our Salinas Valley, the best two words to say. When you need a car, truck, say My Chevrolet.
For your next new or pre-owned car, truck, or SUV, check out the great lineup of vehicles and fantastic deals now at My Chevrolet.
My Chevrolet.
My Chevrolet, in the Salinas Auto Mall.
Hi, this is Terry Crews, actor, former football player, and father of five. I'm also an expert on drama. There's a good kind that comes with having a house full of kids, and there's silly drama like the drama around my percolating pectorals. And then there's the drama you can skip.
Skip the drama that comes with not having your high school diploma or equivalency. Find free adult education classes near you and finish your diploma. Visit finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org.
And lead the drama to actors like me.
Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ed Council.
Voices for Children. CASA ensures that children placed in foster homes receive the care and services they need to be safe and thrive, while also pursuing permanent homes for them. Community volunteers, trained as court-appointed special advocates, provide practical support and rights-based advocacy. Serving as an extension of the dependency court, CASAs monitor the children and develop personal relationships with them, reporting to the court on their progress every 6 months. Children in foster care with a CASA do better at home, academically, and have a better chance of a speedy, permanent placement. Voices for Children CASA proudly serves 100 of these fragile children today, but we have another 100 on our waiting list. Call 831-455-6800 to learn about advocacy. Change their lives and yours.
Thank you.
Mr. Wagner and Winnick on the Law. Our topic today is gaming law, and we have as a guest attorney Christopher Soriano. Christopher is a partner with the law firm of Duane Morris, and he works out of the, is it Cherry Hill, New Jersey? Christopher, did I get that right?
Yeah, Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
Great. Now, before we went on the break, the topic of, we were talking about internet gambling or internet gaming, and I wanted to get into the fantasy sports or fantasy football. What kind of laws are implicated there, and what can you share as far as legality or illegality? I sense a wet blanket's coming our way.
No. See, I have far less of a wet blanket on this one than I had on your first question.
What a relief.
The interesting thing about fantasy sports is this, and I'm sure you've seen it, and you know, anybody who's following law a little bit knows that this is really a developing area right now, and so the answers that we talk about now could be different in a week or a month or depending on what state we're in. But there's an important distinction that we have to draw in terms of fantasy sports, and that's the traditional season-long fantasy sports contests versus these newer type products, which are daily fantasy sports contests. There's no real dispute in most states that a season-long fantasy sports contest, like people have been doing for 30 or 40 years with their friends, is fine. There's really very, very little dispute about that.
And is that because they argue that there's a skill involved, so it doesn't fit your consideration, prize, and chance rule?
That's exactly right. And that's the question now. The question is becoming, where is the line between when something is a contest of skill and when something is a contest of chance? The logic has been that for me to be able to pick a bunch of players under a salary cap, draft them every week, put them on my team every week based on who my team is playing, and go from there, really makes that a skill-based contest as opposed to gambling.
Okay, Chris, I get that part. That sounds like you're actually serving sort of as a scout in a way, right?
Yes, absolutely.
You're selecting the players.
And not to get too far in the weeds, but if I'm a horse aficionado and I know the jockeys and I know the horses and I'm going to a racetrack, how is that different?
Very interesting question, because we have defined essentially we've defined as a matter of law that horse racing is gambling.
So we just did it by definition.
We did it by definition.
And then we shut our eyes to that definition when we wanted to look at season-long fantasy sports.
Yeah, there's been a traditional view. Well, and the same question comes up, you know, again, not to get any further in the weeds, but the same question comes up with poker.
Because sure.
There's this huge debate about whether poker's a game of chance or a game of skill.
Right.
So there are a lot of these are really what you could say are somewhat arbitrary choices about what you know, what things we view as gambling and what things we don't view as gambling. The biggest question that I see in daily fantasy sports, which obviously is this what you've been seeing a lot in the news, where people do a season long fantasy type deal, but they do it in one day. And you find out the results of your entry on, you know, the same day you make it, rather than going through the whole NFL season. Some states are starting to take the view, like New York, for instance, has really been giving the daily fantasy sports operators a hard time, saying that this is gambling under New York law because it's too much chance and no skill. Well, let's accept that premise for a minute. Let's just, for purposes of argument, let's accept that premise. Well, let me ask this, and it's a rhetorical question, but where's the line? If we're saying that season-long fantasy is legal, no problem there, is a contest of skill, but that daily fantasy, 1 week of an NFL game, is a contest of chance, well, what happens if I do a four-week league?
Right. It gets really hard to draw that line, doesn't it?
Yeah. At what point do I have to, you know, at what point does my daily fantasy contest not become a daily fantasy contest? Is it over 2 days? Is it over 2 weeks? Is it over 2 months? And that there's no real good answer on that yet.
I read an interesting article back prior to the Super Bowl when there was a discussion that had the two or three really well-known fantasy sports leagues not decided to make such a huge splash by advertising right through the middle of the Super Bowl, they really were flying under the radar in a lot of these jurisdictions, but that they kind of poked everybody in the eye with those ads, and that some are saying it's their own problem? I mean, that they've created, that had they left it alone, it would have led kind of gray. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Yeah, I don't think so. Eventually, this activity would have been noticed by, some regulator or some attorney general out there. A lot of times the way these type things get on people's radar is someone feels like, a customer feels like they weren't treated fairly. It doesn't have to be fantasy sports. It could be anything that ultimately is, construed to be gambling or illegal. And they call the attorney general and say, hey, I feel like I got ripped off by this guy. The attorney general investigates and then says, here's what's going on. Perhaps the fact that this got onto the radar so quickly, perhaps the amount of advertising, amount of attention came in, caused this to get onto the radar a little more quickly than it otherwise might have, but... My suspicion is just as this industry grew, with it was going to come a lot of eyes that were going to be placed on it. And maybe the timing would have been a little different, but I think at some point various states were going to start taking a look at this.
Chris, in California we have a lot of card rooms. Do you have card rooms in New Jersey?
We don't have any card rooms in New Jersey because all gaming in New Jersey takes place in our full-scale casinos or at racetracks.
That's what I thought. Okay, so
and we were kind of wondering. I'm not sure whether you know the California law, but I've always been puzzled as how, because California is not one of the states that has I guess they have dog racing in the south. There's some horse racing. And then there are these card rooms, and that's all they do is card rooms. And I guess the house doesn't take a piece of it, and that somehow is part of the... definition. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with that? Can you help us on that?
I'm not as familiar with the full details of how the card rooms in California work. What I can say is I know a lot of the gambling that takes place in California is done by Indian tribes. It's administered by Indian tribes, which have compacts with the state of California that authorize them to offer various forms of gambling.
And I thought it was interesting. And they're allowed to do it off the reservation. I mean, they are allowed to. I could understand when they were on the reservation and had federal law applying, but they, I guess, as you say, they have a compact with the state of California that allows them to go to better real estate locations.
Yeah, that may be the case. I'm not as familiar with the card room concept under state law. One argument, you certainly raised an argument that's interesting and that other folks have tried. In other states, and that is that if the house is not taking a piece, in other words, if people are just playing against each other and all you're paying the house for when you're playing poker is the right to sit at the table or to defray the cost of the electricity or whatnot, perhaps that's not a game in which you're playing against the house, in which case the house is not
I think that is the logic, Chris. It comes in the form of an ante, of course, but I think that is true. We're coming up on our next break. Chris, when we come back, we want to talk a little bit about the flow of the money and the oversight in New Jersey or the states where gambling is legal. You're listening to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. We're talking about gaming law today, and our guest is attorney Christopher Soriano. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Applying to Monterey College of Law is not hard, and we have a financial plan and class schedule that is tailored to meet your needs. I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. Have you ever dreamed of being a lawyer? We at Monterey College of Law can help make that dream come true without crippling you with debt on graduation day.
I chose Monterey College of Law because I wanted to continue working during the day. I had children at home, and I wanted to be able to go to school at night where it wouldn't impact what my children needed from me.
There really is not crippling debt that you face afterwards. Monterey College of Law has a payment plan which is manageable, and they work with you. The other huge benefit of Monterey College of Law is that the professors are judges and lawyers. By taking their classes, you really actually start networking. So I was very fortunate because I also ended up with a mentor.
There's never been a better time to become a lawyer. Call us today at 582-4000 or visit us online at montereylaw.edu. For decades, the students at Monterey College of Law have graduated and gone on to pass the bar and become successful attorneys. However, not everyone goes to Monterey College of Law to become an attorney. I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. We also offer students our 2-year Master of Legal Studies degree, which can enhance their chosen careers.
I was working as a deputy coroner for San Mateo County as a death scene investigator, and I wanted a better idea of the legal issues that were involved in forensic investigations. Everything about Monterey College of Law was accommodating to the course of study I was trying to find. I graduated from Monterey College of Law with no outstanding debt. I'm working as an investigator for the San Mateo County Private Defender's Office, performing indigent defense investigations.
For more information, call us today at 582-4000. That's 582-4000. Or visit us online at montereylaw.edu. That's montereylaw.edu.
Here is a tip for all who want to get the most for their money. Ready? Think local first. Yep, it's as simple as thinking local. First. When you think local first and shop the locally owned independent businesses of Santa Cruz County, more of your money will stay here so you can spend the money again and again and again. How much more will you get for your money? Get this. Five $100 Think Local First checks circulated for 30 days within the Santa Cruz County business community generated $8,711.48 in local business. You heard right. $500 generated $8,711.48. Now, how much business do you think $500 would generate if spent on Made in China at the big box store? Not much, right? You will get more for your money, a lot more for your money, when you think local first and shop the locally owned independent businesses of Santa Cruz County. Look for the logo, and then shop for the logo, and think local first. Thank you.
Legal Services for Seniors, a nonprofit law firm, provides no-cost legal assistance to seniors in their two offices in Salinas and Seaside and in outreach locations throughout Monterey County, King City, Greenfield, Soledad, Gonzales, Castroville, Prunedale, Carmel Valley, Pacific Grove, Carmel, and Monterey. LSS attorneys and legal advocates can help with legal issues such as landlord-tenant conflicts, Medicare insurance mix-ups, Social Security mistakes, consumer fraud, elder abuse, wills, advanced health care directives, guardianships, and more. Find out more about Legal Services for Seniors online at lssmc.net or call one of our offices in Salinas, Seaside, or one of the many outreach sites throughout Monterey County at 899-0492 or 442-7700.
In our challenging times, some couples just grow apart, and sometimes divorce is the only answer. Divorce is a difficult time for both of you and your kids. It can be expensive. Mediation rather than litigation creates an amicable way to get through a difficult time. That's why the Mandel-Gisnet Center at the Monterey College of Law is now offering a new program that makes it affordable for low-income locals. This divorce mediation program is located at the Mandel-Gisnet Nonprofit Mediation and Training Center at the Monterey College of Law and is aimed at couples who qualify based on income guidelines and offers sliding scale fees. Wednesday afternoon and evening appointments are available. For more information or to apply, go to MandelGisnetCenter.org or call 831-582-5234. This is a difficult time. Don't let it bankrupt you, too.
Welcome back to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. If you are just joining us, we've been talking about gaming law, and we're fortunate enough to have as a guest today attorney Christopher Soriano. Mr. Soriano is a partner with the law firm of Duane Morris. And Christopher, before the break, I raised the topic of really following the money in the gaming industry, and I'm speaking now about legal gambling, and I was hoping you can get into the topic of the regulations and who oversees the flow of the money. The Gaming Control Board, I think, is something that you're familiar with too. So a little bit about the venues, where you go to settle disputes. What kind of tribunals or venues do you find yourself working in?
Sure. There's very thorough state gaming regulatory processes in place in every jurisdiction in the United States that has legalized gaming. Nevada, for example, has had the Nevada Gaming Control Board and the Nevada Gaming Commission for many years. New Jersey has had two agencies, the Casino Control Commission and the Division of Gaming Enforcement, that have both been on the job since gaming became legal in 1978. As gaming lawyers, we deal with the gaming regulatory authorities in every jurisdiction in which we have clients who have needs. And they follow the state gaming statutes that have been enacted by the legislature, and they've also promulgated in every state very, very thorough sets of regulations that govern all aspects of a casino's operation, all aspects of what it means to be a supplier to those casinos, rules of the games, patron dispute procedures, as you've mentioned. They really cover the whole gamut, and they watch very carefully every area of a casino's operations to ensure that everything is conducted in an upright manner. Everyone who participates in the industry on the investment side, on the ownership side, is checked, sometimes very, very thoroughly, depending on which state you're in and what ownership interest they have. Wait,
only sometimes very, very thoroughly?
Well,
depending on, I love that. Sometimes very, very thoroughly, depending on what state you're in. So which states don't do it thoroughly?
Well, no, it's really based on, it's really based on what type of interest you have and what percentage. So for example, there's a lot of publicly traded companies involved in the gaming industry. So if I own 100 shares of a publicly traded company in the gaming industry that's got 3 billion shares outstanding on Wall Street, and I own 100 shares of that company, I'm technically an owner of the casino.
Right, but the scrutiny over your purchase would be zero.
Zero.
That's right.
Because
I get it.
Because most states have put thresholds in place where below a certain threshold, you're not subject to the state's regulatory
process. Well, that makes sense.
Because
sure.
You're deemed to not be able to control. And
okay.
that's you can control or influence.
Yeah, Chris, I was going to say there's an attenuation factor there, no doubt, right?
Sure, sure. It's control or influence is really what regulators are looking at.
Chris, I thought it was interesting recently. You know, one of the issues came up with, and Stephen was bringing up the factor of money, and you talked about how each state does it. But, you know, Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, I mean, these are companies that deal with the flow of transactions across jurisdictions, and yet they had to make some decisions as to whether they're being part of an illegal multi-state gambling operation, I assume.
They did, and interestingly enough, when online gaming became a reality in New Jersey, a number of the payment processors decided that this was too close to the line. They did not want to participate. They did not want to process payments. And have not. It's still difficult to get some online gaming operators in New Jersey to accept your standard MasterCard or your standard Visa card because the payment processor that they work through has not been able to reach a level of comfort internally that this is not going to cause them an issue under federal law. And that's despite the fact that the Attorney General in New Jersey issued an opinion letter when online gaming started in New Jersey. The Attorney General issued an opinion letter saying, the casino operators in New Jersey that are offering online gaming are complying, in our view, with both federal and state law, and we will not take any action against any payment processor. That still didn't lead to a large level of comfort for a lot of these credit card type operators.
Chris, I have a question for you about card games, and I don't frequent casinos enough really to be conversant necessarily, but each time I go to a casino, and it is infrequently, I see a new game of chance, a new card game. Can you walk through the procedures of what a casino owner would need to do if they want to introduce some new game of chance?
Absolutely, and that's something I do on a regular basis, actually, in my practice. There are several companies out there that are in the business of developing games. They develop and license or lease content to various casinos. Typically, the way it works is the casino will either go to one of these companies and say, I'm interested in, we'll call it a variety of blackjack. We'll use that as our hypothetical. I'm interested in this different type of blackjack game. Do you have anything that suits my need? Or a company will develop a new game and go to a casino and say, hey, we've got this great new type blackjack. It looks like blackjack, but it isn't quite. It's got all these enhancements. Would you be interested in offering this game in your casino? So you need a deal between a casino and a licensed vendor manufacturer, and those companies that offer games are very thoroughly vetted by gaming regulators.
Okay, so Chris, let me unwind it. This is intriguing to me. So, because it sounds like there's almost a lobbying component in what you said there. Somebody's in the industry that actually works through the game to see how it would work mechanically. They work with a casino, and if the casino ownership group approves of the game and likes the idea of instituting it, would it then be presented to one of these boards? Is that where you would get involved potentially?
That is exactly what happens. What we then do is we take all the information and we take it to the gaming regulator.
And I assume it's information like the percent of win. I assume there's the regulations concerned about the consumer's chance of winning, I assume. Is that where it fits?
They do want to know what the chance of winning is. They also want to understand that the game is going to be fair, that the rules of the game are going to be able to be clearly explained to a patron who walks up and sits down, that this is a game that can be audited, that can be watched by the surveillance cameras, that can be audited, that it just all around fits with the type of game you would expect to have in a casino.
And do different states have different rules on what the win percentage needs to be in order to be fair within their state law?
So for table games, not particularly. There is an industry standard. Some states have a minimum percentage that a slot machine must return in order for the slot machine to be approved as a gaming device in the state. For example, the Casino Control Act in New Jersey requires that all slot machines pay back 83% minimum. So of every $100 that's put in, 83% of it, $83 has to be paid back. Now, remember,
I have to tell you, that has not been my experience.
it has been very few people's experience.
Chris, Mitch is going to go out and test it. He's going to test the theory.
Well, let me tell you this.
Okay.
Let me tell you this. Don't test it with $100 because that's... That said, if you don't test it with $100 and you turn it into $200, I get a cut. But otherwise, but that's a theoretical payback percentage over the lifetime of the machine. In other words, you look at every possible winning combination that the machine will pay. You look at how that lines up. You look at the payouts for them, and you run them through this massive computer that runs these simulations and says, you know, over a million pulls of the lever on this machine, it will pay back this percentage. And just so you're aware, there are no slot machines. There are very, very few slot machines anywhere in the United States that pay at a percentage that low. The standard payback percentage, the average payback percentage that you see in most casinos across the United States is between 89 and 92%. But remember, a large portion of that comes from somebody hitting the mega jackpot.
So there's a lot of us that put $100 in there to pay to get that total racked up to when one person hits the big one.
And the one person's going to get it, and that one person is going to push, you know, that one payout is probably going to be 10% of the theoretical payout on the machine.
Yeah, that's a lot of comfort for Mitch, Chris. He now knows he's part of that person's glee.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing when somebody wins the lottery. I'm like, gee, I hope you enjoy my $20. You know, that's the...
that's exactly right. I want to talk a little more about gambling, and then in our final segment, I want to spend time on the lottery because I think there's some interesting questions here. But so what? Give us an example of one of the most challenging questions you've had to deal with on behalf of a gambling client.
Well, we typically deal with we deal with a lot. We deal with questions that sometimes the most complex questions come up in states that are new to offering gambling. So I'll use Pennsylvania for example. When Pennsylvania decided to implement gambling, it followed a model that was different from New Jersey's and from Nevada's. Nevada's model has always been, if you have a piece of land and you can get a casino license, you can build a
Chris,
casino.
Chris, hold that thought. When we come back, we'll let you continue your story of this challenging experience that you had with Pennsylvania. You're listening to Wagner and Winnick on the Law on the BizTalk Radio Network, and our topic today has been gaming law, and our guest is attorney Christopher Soriano. Don't go away. We'll be right back for our final segment.
Making a change in career is a serious decision that affects both you and your family. You have many questions that need to be answered before you can make a commitment. I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. Have you ever dreamed of being a lawyer? We at Monterey College of Law can help make that dream come true. And it's affordable. But don't take it from me. Hear what recent graduate Dan Cullum says.
Before I was entering law school, I was an airline pilot. After I retired, I decided that I would go to law school. Monterey College of Law was the avenue to fulfill that desire. I love Monterey College of Law. It was small classes. The professors were very helpful, personal. You could talk to them. Tuition is not exorbitant at Monterey College of Law, which is the opposite of the way it is at other places. It's affordable. They have a program at Monterey College of Law that lets you pay as you go, so it's financially possible.
There's never been a better time to become a lawyer. Call us today at 582-4000 or visit us online at montereylaw.edu.
Long before Woody's cruised Beach Street, kids and teens have needed to know that they are important and that they belong. Since 1969, the Boys and Girls Club of Santa Cruz has provided a place where potential is released and great futures are forged. Help celebrate our 45th anniversary by emailing your club memories and pictures to celebrate45years at boysandgirlsclub.info or call 423-3138, extension 23. We are also excited to announce that Monterey College of Law is providing one full tuition law school scholarship each year to a former Boys and Girls Club participant. Contact Executive Director Bob Langseth at 423-3138, extension 21, or email Bob at boysandgirlsclub.info to learn more about this exciting opportunity.
My Chevrolet, when you need a car, truck, say My Chevrolet, in our Salinas Valley, the best two words to say. When you need a car, truck, say My Chevrolet.
For your next new or pre-owned car, truck, or SUV, check out the great lineup of vehicles and fantastic deals now at My Chevrolet.
My Chevrolet.
My Chevrolet in the Salinas Auto Mall.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg roll showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Legal Services for Seniors, a nonprofit law firm, provides no-cost legal assistance to Monterey County seniors age 60 and above. LSS attorneys and legal advocates can help with legal issues such as landlord-tenant conflicts, Medicare insurance mix-ups, Social Security mistakes, consumer fraud, elder abuse, wills, advanced health care directives, and more. LSS also helps Monterey County seniors obtain guardianship for grandchildren and other family members 18 and younger in their care. Under legal guardianship, you can arrange medical care, give parental consult for school and sports activities, and secure other benefits. Find out more about legal services for seniors online at lssmc.net or call one of our offices in Salinas, Seaside, or one of the many outreach sites throughout Monterey County at 899-0492 or 442-7700. 899-0492 or 442-7700.
Do you need an attorney? The Monterey County Bar Association and the Santa Cruz County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Services can help you. The Lawyer Referral Services maintain a list of pre-screened attorneys available to help you with your specific legal needs. Along with specialized knowledge in a particular field of law, each attorney is an active member of the County Bar Association and has malpractice insurance coverage. How much does the lawyer referral service cost? To receive a referral, you pay a non-refundable $50 administrative fee that supports the lawyer referral service. In return, you receive a 30-minute in-person free consultation with a private attorney. So, if you need legal help and do not have an attorney, in Monterey County, call 831-582-3600 or go to www.montereycountybar.org. In Santa Cruz County, call 831-425-4600.
4755 or go to www.santacruzbar.org.
Welcome back to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. We are in our stretch drive. It's the last segment, and our guest today is attorney Christopher Soriano, and he is very well versed in gaming law. And Chris, before we took a break, you were winding up and telling a story about one of the challenging cases that you have encountered.
Yes. So what I was saying was newer states that have implemented gambling have done so on a limited basis. Casino gambling, I'm talking about. So when they've opened up, they've said, you know, rather than what Atlantic City does, which is if you have a piece of land and can build a 500-room hotel and can qualify, you can get a casino license. What these states have said is we're only going to issue 3 licenses or 4 licenses or 12 licenses to the whole state. And we're going to have a competition, essentially, and determine not only are you qualified to hold a casino license, meaning do you have good character and, you know, necessary financial wherewithal, but we're going to qualitatively judge all the proposals we receive and decide which of the 2 or 3 or 4 is going to receive a license.
And that will not be a game of chance, right?
No, that will not be a game of chance.
And then let's myth bust here a little bit more, because Steve and I were talking about the break. So, you know, now only 2 or 3 or 4 companies are going to end up winning. I mean, I think most of us still presume that there's an element of organized crime hiding in those corporate boardrooms of the mega companies that run these things. True or false?
False. Absolutely false. These companies are subject to so much oversight, it is not even funny. The amount of investigation that goes in to anyone who's associated with a casino license is really unbelievable. They will look at, I mean, I have had clients call me and say to me, I don't remember why I withdrew $400 from the ATM in San Francisco 3 years ago, but I just got a letter from an investigator at the Gaming Control Board wanting to know why I did.
Wow.
And that's the level of detail that goes into. If I sent you a photo of, you know, for instance, we filed an application on behalf of a client in New York that was seeking a casino license there. We had to call the Gaming Control Board and ask them where should we back the truck up, because that's how much paper we had to deliver to them as part of this application process.
All right, well, I think that gives everybody a little more comfort in that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one other question that I want to sneak in here, because there's certainly an international gaming component here, and I've traveled frequently to Costa Rica, love the country, but that's a major industry there, having the computer backbone that runs a lot of online gaming. Is it a pitch and catch issue that obviously Costa Rica doesn't care where your IP address is when they're allowing the company to take gambling, but would it be just equally as illegal if I'm placing my bet from a state that its gambling is illegal if that resulting website's in Costa Rica?
It is. It is illegal for you to do that, but the real enforcement teeth that's in place came from the federal law in 2006, the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act, that prohibited banks and payment processors from being involved in transactions like that, because that's always been illegal. But you had, banks that were just processed, you know, the actual placing of the bet offshore has always been really illegal, but it was almost impossible to enforce. So the banks finally had to clamp down on it. And that's where some of the flow of funds got cut off. But there's still, there are still plenty of offshore sites that are taking bets from U.S. companies.
And so let me ask you one other question I had then, because we're running out of time, but let's talk the lottery a minute. There are 44 states, evidently, that have a lottery. How is it that you can have things such as this Mega Ball, which certainly sounds like, to me, it is selling tickets across all these jurisdictions? How does that work when you said every state has to have its own law?
So here's how it works. First of all, any state that's participating in Powerball or Mega Millions has authorized that wager by state law. But what's actually happening is you are buying that ticket from the lottery in your own state. The lottery in your own state is then just reconciling with a consortium of other lotteries in determining who the winner is and what the pool looks like. You don't actually, like, if I go buy a Powerball ticket in New Jersey, it's the New Jersey lottery that sells me the lottery ticket. But in addition, all of these states, if, you know, it's not Powerball that sells me the ticket. It's the New Jersey Lottery. So it's a transaction solely within the state. But all of these states have also entered into reciprocal agreements that allow them to share data and other information. And since it's considered legal, it doesn't raise any issues under federal.
Well, that's a bit of a legal squint, isn't it? Because it's not just that they've sold it. All that money has to get consolidated somewhere to pay out the big ticket, right? So the person in New Jersey does it, but somebody in Tennessee wins.
Yeah, there's an adjustment made. There's a reconciliation made at the end of the day by these states.
So where do you think online gambling's going to go? So clearly there's been an enormous growth. I read an article that said it hasn't grown quite as quickly in the three states that have made it legal as they thought it might. But it's not going anywhere. It just seems too logical that it's going to grow. Where do you think the industry will grow?
I think the industry is going to grow fairly significantly, and I think the industry is going to – what I think states that are in need of tax dollars are going to start to realize is – why would I fit out my own intrastate system here in state X when I could enter into an interstate compact with somebody like New Jersey who already has this running, essentially make it legal for people in my state to place bets in New Jersey, and then have New Jersey send me back a portion of the tax revenue? Now you've got economies of scale in play. Now you've got a state like New Jersey serving as the internet gaming hub for 10 different states. And you're also creating large pools of players, which is something you need to make online poker work. Online poker has not worked very well in Delaware because Delaware is such a small state and there's so few people playing online poker. To make money on online poker as an operator, you need to have thousands of people playing because you need to be taking a rake off the table. So I think there's going to be a move toward a system where states start compacting with each other. And where you start really developing those economies of scale, where operators can base themselves in one state, accept all their bets there, and essentially just channel tax revenue back to the state where the player is in.
Well, thanks, Chris. This has been great. You've helped us on a lot of you've helped us understand a lot of these laws. It must be a very interesting practice for you. Thanks for being our guest today.
Oh, it's fascinating. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you,
Chris.
We hope to call on you again. Thank you.
Well, Stephen, let me remind everybody that they can hear a repeat of today's program and archives of previous programs at WagnerandWinnick.com and also at BizTalkRadio.com. So until next week, if you don't know the law, know a lawyer.